Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University, and this is my colleague and co-host, Sam.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So the world of politics is pretty crazy these days, and the stakes are incredibly high. One of the main storylines besides President Trump or in relation to President Trump is what's happened to the conservative movement in this period. How is it transforming? How does it connect to the current president? And what's going to happen going into the midterm elections and the next presidential election? Some of the tensions in the conservative movement that have been there for many decades have come out as a result of this very polarizing president on issues such as trade, on issues such as society and culture, the economy and healthcare, and simply the norms of government. And at the same time, progressives are also wondering what happens next. Is this a moment where there is potentially a revival of progressive politics in response to this administration? Or are we at a moment where the institutions and organization of politics favor the Republican Party and favor President Trump, regardless, really, of what he does? So lots of questions on the table, lots of concerns. And today we are very fortunate to have with us E.J. Dionne, who is a columnist for The Washington Post, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a professor at Georgetown University. He has written, in addition to his phenomenal columns, many, many important books on the politics of our times, Why Americans Hate Politics, They Only Look Dead, Community Work, Sold Out, Why the Right Went Wrong, and many more. He recently wrote with Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, with St. Martin's Press. EJ, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let me start with this question. I first met EJ Sam in 1995. I was a graduate
when
student.
When you were 12.
I was 12. Yeah, now, as a graduate student at Brookings.
I wish I could say I was 13, you know.
At Brookings, and I was finishing my dissertation. And I think that's the year EJ had joined Brookings as a fellow as well. And that was the year of the government shutdown. That's when Bill Clinton got into a confrontation with the new Republican Congress led by Newt Gingrich, and the government would shut down. It was a pretty big crisis. It certainly felt that way at the time. But at the time, it also felt that we were as divided as we ever were, and that polarization had really become totally dysfunctional, that we reached that point. So I'm curious, now looking back, are things worse than where we were in the 1990s, or do we have a nostalgia about how things were at that time?
Those were the good old days, weren't they? Actually, it's good that you raise that, because in the book we make an argument that what we are facing now really began back then, and that what we're seeing is not a break with the long trajectory since the 90s, but a continuity, almost its logical or illogical conclusion. Because it was really with the Gingrich Congress that you saw the Republicans pursue more radical strategies, and where the party on the whole radicalized. In their earlier book, Tom and Norm talked about the Republicans becoming insurgent outliers in American politics. You also saw in that period an acceleration of moderates out of the Republican Party. You'd already seen liberals leave the Republican Party. And ironically, when Gingrich was elected as the Republican leader, he got quite a few votes from moderate Republicans. But over time, they lost primaries, or they were knocked out eventually by Democrats, the moderates were, because they tended to represent districts, Connie Morella in Maryland, a good example, that were fundamentally Democratic, but liked good moderate to progressive Republicans. With the Gingrich leadership, voters in those districts said, you know, we may like this person, but we don't want to empower this majority. And so it led over time to where we got with Trump. And one of the things we underscore in the book is that Republicans in the Tea Party period could have stood up to some of the excesses of the Tea Party. For example, they could have stood up to Donald Trump when he became a birther and said that Barack Obama was actually, or implied that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. They didn't stand up to those forces. When Mitt Romney, who became a critic of Trump's, got his endorsement for president in 2012, he gave an extraordinarily flattering speech. It's almost embarrassing to watch how excited he said he was to be in Trump's hotel or one of Trump's facilities in Las Vegas. So, yes, I think the 90s is the place where this began, and it's just gotten worse.
Well, I was just talking to a friend's son who's a high school freshman, and he didn't seem to really quite grasp how weird things have gotten. I know we're recording and see, we can't see this, but one thing in my data, just going to talk about the data.
Sam, I love you. You even show
I'm showing
charts
a chart
on the radio.
Oh, we're recording this podcast.
Well, that's a wonderful
thing. So for the listeners out there, this is something I'm showing EJ, a thing from the American Prospect I wrote about the decline of presidential campaign volatility. And right around that time, the amount by which opinion could change during the course of a presidential campaign dropped by about two-thirds right after Gingrich took over. And so there's just this choosing up of sides, this polarization that you're talking about where, you know, like liberals leave the Republican Party, the parties become separated from one another. But voters themselves became entrenched and they just stopped changing their minds during a campaign. And so this measure of volatility shows, yeah, I'm sorry, everybody, I know it's ridiculous to show a chart on a podcast,
okay.
But, you know,
everyone can imagine.
I think it's a demonstration of your commitment to data.
But the point is that there was really this phase transition, a change in the weather that was just sharp and long-lasting, and it goes back to that time when Gingrich changed the tone. I mean, from Bob Michael, right? Nice gentleman, out of power permanently, well-controlled by the majority, and then to Newt Gingrich, who's throwing bombs. And I don't know, no wonder the moderate Republicans thought they'd like to vote for the guy, because he probably made them feel alive.
Right. No, that was part of it, in fact, why Gingrich got some of those votes. And Gingrich, in some sense, at least had some appreciation for the fact that his speakership depended on holding those districts. But the nature of his leadership made it more and more difficult to hold those districts. But what you're also seeing there is voters responding to the realities of politics, that when parties become more consistently ideological, particularly in the case of the Republican Party, where the proportion of people who call themselves conservative rose from roughly half or even a little less than half back in the 80s to roughly two-thirds or more now and even before, you know, even a few years back. Voters take a look and say, okay, I know what that party is. Democrats have a little bit more of a complicated image, partly because they still very much need their moderates in Senate races. I think the nature of the Senate makes the Democratic imperatives, political imperatives, more complicated. But voters take a look and say, I really can't go there anymore. There used to be people in that party I could vote for comfortably. And then, of course, back in the 70s, no Democrat who voted for a moderate Republican thought they were risking Republican control of the Congress. And that was a big deal.
And the other flip side, or the other side of the mid-1990s is Fox Television emerges. And
was that 98? Was
I
it?
I thought it was 96.
It was 96. What you had even earlier, and they're connected, was the emergence of talk radio,
right,
and Rush Limbaugh in particular, who spawned all sorts of imitators in the late 1980s.
Right.
There's an interesting story. We talk a little bit about it in the book, that in a way, Rush Limbaugh was the progenitor of Fox News, because Roger Ailes tried to turn Rush Limbaugh into a TV show.
Yeah.
And Rush was not exactly perfect for television. I say that with some sympathy. I'm not in the best shape myself.
Uh-huh.
Born with a face made for radio or podcasts.
Yeah.
But you know, that didn't work. But instead of giving up on the project, Ailes just went bigger, and he went and started Fox News. And I think you can't underestimate the importance of Fox News usurping some of the power within the party from formal leaders of the party, that Fox News had an ability to set the agenda for the party by influencing such a large number of Republican activists and base voters.
Well, rapid communication, right? So the ability of people to find like-minded people, feel less alone, form a tribe that's separated by thousands of miles, but still, you know, feeling the same way, reacting the same way to cultural buttons being pushed or what have you.
Right. And what's interesting is you had a lively right-wing media back in the 1960s. Right. Phyllis Schlafly's A Choice Not an Echo, published with a basically self-created publishing house, I think sold well over 2 million copies. None Dare Call It Treason, another right-wing bestseller in the 60s, sold a large number of books. But these were off to the side of the mainstream culture because they didn't really penetrate mainstream television. Mainstream television tended to be down the middle conservative Republicans, down the middle conservative Democrats. What Fox News did and talk radio did, and now what the new media do, is allow these previously marginal and in many cases extremist positions to enter the broader conversation. And that also has an effect on how we look at this.
Students talk about InfoWars.
Right.
Right. And they know that it's ridiculous.
You mean what they hear on it?
They know that it's ridiculous, but they know about InfoWars. They think that Alex Jones is a buffoon, rightly so. But they at the same time, they're aware of what he says. And so he's part of the conversation in a way that, you know, finding some weird book on a bookshelf. Right. What's that? Who's Phyllis Schlafly? You know, you can imagine walking to someone's house and saying, "Ooh, you got one of those books. What is that?"
Right. And they often were self-published, you know. Yet they were within the conservative and right-wing network bestsellers.
Huge, right.
But they were huge only to a small piece of the population.
So you wrote in an earlier book, Why Americans Hate Politics, you wrote about the conservative movement and the different strands coming together and how William Buckley, for example, was able to find points of commonality. Then you've written about 90s through today, where you have different factors, whether it's the Gingrich Republicans and the Tea Party or this media are kind of moving the movement in a very rightward direction, obstructionist direction. And then you wrote in a column, it's time to read the last rights over the conservative movement recently. Can you explain what you're thinking and how you see it?
Right. That column was about the Conservative Political Action Conference, where I thought it was sort of the triumph of the apotheosis of the extremist takeover of the conservative movement. The conference organizers invited Marion Maréchal Le Pen, a leader of the neo-fascist National Front in France. She appeared at the same meeting that Mike Pence appeared at. She appeared at the same meeting that Ted Cruz appeared at. And then you also had this extraordinary speech by Wayne LaPierre of the NRA at a moment when the country was focused on mourning what had happened down in Florida, that terrible shooting down in Florida. And it was something you would not have had a neo-fascist at what had been a mainstream event. Yes, CPAC was always a little out there, but usually it was a little out there in a libertarian direction as part of, which is a part of the mainstream of the conservative movement. Now you have this brand of ethno-nationalism becoming almost dominant on the right. And so when I was saying, I wasn't arguing that conservatism was disappearing, but I was arguing that what we thought of as a kind of mainstream conservative movement, and I'm talking about pretty conservative. You know, Bill Buckley was no slouch. He was pretty right-wing. There were plenty of people who were very conservative, but this is in a completely different place.
So a shift from ideas to white nationalism. I mean, you know, ethno-nationalism. I mean, let's not, put lipstick on. I mean, this is like white nationalism, and it's apparently a major – these are players with a major seat at the table now in what calls itself the conservative movement.
Right. Well, with Steve Bannon himself, who had a leading position in the White House until he was bounced in the shakeup. And you have all – and Stephen Miller is still there who represents that force in the movement. And Donald Trump and his campaign was very explicit over and over, beginning on the very first day when he talked about Mexican immigrants as rapists. He was sending very powerful signals. And then came his response to Charlottesville, where he created a kind of moral equivalence between extreme white nationalists and people who were resisting them. This is something we shouldn't gloss this over. It's not McCarthyism to say that the president himself has given signals and said things that fit very neatly into a white nationalist narrative.
But these are all products of some. I mean, these people may have these views, but it's not like they led the Republican Party that way. There's this wave of ethno-nationalism in countries around the, in developed countries, in Western European countries, Eastern European countries, where they're doing quite well and actually taking over government. And so there's this force that seems to be coming up from the right and becoming fairly dominant. And then that force picks out somebody like Trump, who is able to push their buttons quite well, and they say, okay, he's our guy.
Right. And the question is, but Trump, I think there was more of an interaction there, because I think Trump historically, with what brought Trump to public prominence in this period, it was birtherism, that Trump himself was playing at this kind of politics. And the, you know, people like Steve Bannon, who were trying to build this right-wing ethno-nationalist populism, saw in Trump a natural ally. So I think it went both ways.
Sure,
Trump empowered them, that this movement could not have gotten there, I think, as quickly without Trump, but Trump couldn't have gotten there without this movement.
Well, remember how risible in the first Republican debate when he started talking about building a southern wall, I would say the kind of staid mainstream pundit reaction is that it was ridiculous. And then, you know, in terms of polling support, he just stayed up at 40%. He went up, if anything, and he never went back down. He never fluctuated in the Republican polls the way that Mitt Romney did. He was stronger than Romney throughout all the primaries. And I think to some extent people were blindsided. And, you know, what he was doing there was, I think, pushing the button you're talking about, where he knew their number and he said, okay, I think you want to hear about keeping out the brown people.
Well, I think there was that. And then there was also his dissidence, which is not now reflected in policy, although it was in his protectionist move on steel and aluminum recently.
If it goes through,
he may back off, as he often does. But, you know, he was breaking with Republican orthodoxy, for example, on cutting Medicare or Medicaid. And now, of course, he's reversed on that. But he was also sending a signal to the working class, lower middle class parts of the Republican electorate that he was different from those other kinds of Republicans. Dare I say it, now that he's thrown in with him completely, he was different from the Paul Ryan kind of Republicans. And yet governing, he has shown himself to be very much part of them. And Ryan has supported him in, I think, a shameful way. And interestingly, the first time Ryan has spoken up is against this tariff, you know, suggesting that money, or if you want to be more charitable, free market principles are the only place he's going to break with Trump, not on Russia, not on our failure to act against interference in our elections. But this was a step too far.
Well, so one story you can tell from everything you've said, and I've told the same stories about the change of the conservative movement and gradually its success at winning over people we thought were the establishment, like a Romney, like a Ryan, but are willing to be part of this party, and they're victorious. They have a president, and that explains where we are. But there's another way of just thinking about where we are, the what is going on perspective, and what's going on with American political institutions and our polity, that we are at a point where some of these ideas are in the mainstream again in 2018. And beyond right and left, the way President Trump acts as president, the kind of disregard for institutions and the craziness of daily life that you cover. You're often on in the media. I've been on television where someone says, this just happened. And there's part of your brain that's like, that can't be true. This must be a prank. What's going on in American politics that we've reached this point after what seemed to be a president, whether you agreed or disagreed, had the kind of traditional institutional decorum and things were still functioning? What's going on?
Right. I think one of the challenging things to people trying to understand this, and I include myself in this, is trying to disentangle to what extent is this simply Trump, that no other leader of even this kind of movement would behave like Trump. And there is an element of Trump that's sui generis, that it's just even the most, imagine the most right-wing Republican politician in Congress. And I just think there are things Trump does that they wouldn't do. So we've got to
He's an entertainer.
Yeah, he is. And people say he's running his own television show. He writes a new script every morning and so on. And so some of it is purely Trump, and he is a person also with autocratic instincts. When, you know, they were trying to write off his statement about
President for life.
President for life.
Yeah, or
but it didn't
China.
Sound like something he was saying for fun when he said it. They explained it afterward. So there's that side of it. But then there is the Republican Party itself and the Republican Party in Congress. And one could make a better case that this is pure aberration if there were more outspokenness within the Republican leadership on any of this. But on the contrary, when you look at the House in particular and the House Intelligence Committee's investigation, which has turned from an investigation into Russian meddling into an effort to throw up every roadblock imaginable to an investigation of Russian meddling with Devin Nunes, and Paul Ryan's saying, well, I'm really powerless to affect this, you know, just letting it go forward. You've gone from purely a Trump phenomenon to something very close to a party-wide phenomenon. And the Republicans resisting this are mostly leaving Congress. You know, two prominent cases, Charlie Dent nearby in Pennsylvania in the House and Jeff Flake in the Senate. And Charlie Dent probably could survive a primary in that district, but Jeff Flake almost certainly couldn't survive a primary in Arizona.
So this is internal to the Republican Party rather than a story about American politics more broadly, meaning everyone's responsible in some ways for what we are watching with President Trump. There's a way to look at it, that we have allowed our institutions to break or we've gone in bad directions. But you think it's primarily a story from within the GOP.
Right. Well, Norm, Tom, and I have all been arguing in different ways for some time now that what we're looking at is asymmetric polarization. And we think you can muster an awful lot of data to suggest that Republicans, both in their elites and their elected class and in their base, have moved much farther to the right of center than Democrats have moved to the left of center. The Democratic Party is still a coalition of more moderate or center-left people and a left, which I think in some ways is still less left than the Republican right is, although maybe that is a matter of perspective. But there's no question that this is asymmetric and that we do hold the Republican Party far more responsible for this than the Democrats.
But it's, you know, you talk about the House Intelligence Committee, and in your column when you wrote about that, there is less of that breakage, less of that willingness to tear down norms and institutions in the Senate, as you pointed out in your column there. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. It seems to me that the congressmen who are on the House Intelligence Committee have to face their voters, have to face their primary voters imminently at any given moment. You know, the most distance they get from their voters is about a year off, as opposed to senators who get a little bit of breathing room. And so it strikes me that that these things are in some sense fear of primary voters, fear of their own party.
Right.
Because some of those people are people who are probably in some alternate situation where they weren't being in the stew of partisanship, might not be the same people.
But, well, you know, what's intriguing is Trey Gowdy in the House is someone who has been pretty aggressive in the past. And he's actually, in the last few weeks, looked, relatively speaking, like a voice of reason. But Trey Gowdy announced
he
wasn't running for re-election, which I'm just making that point to underscore what you said. I think there is something to that. But I think it goes both ways. I think many of these Republicans are actually part of that faction. So there's a combination of fear of primaries, but also I think many of them are actually committed to this position and committed to defending President Trump no matter what.
Well, let me make a point and then ask you a question about this polarization. First, the point I want to make is that on the right, among conservatives and among self-avowed Republicans, there is a near total correspondence. I actually can't think of an exception between people who are willing to speak out against this disruptive last year that we've experienced and people who do not have to face voters. And so it's going to be people like commentators like Charlie Sykes. It's going to be people like Rick Wilson. They don't have to run for office. You just mentioned Trey Gowdy. To the extent that Bob Corker was willing to go off the reservation, it seemed to correspond with retirement. And so there's if you do a statistical test, again, I'm going to be the data nerd here, but like there's a perfect correspondence between those who don't have to run off for office and those being at least partially willing to to speak out.
Oh, there's no question. In fact, I am so struck that almost all the power of anti-Trump conservatism comes from writers and intellectuals and columnists and this very small number of elected officials. Yeah. And so I think your point is well taken. I think one of the interesting things is what will become of these anti-Trump conservatives. I have analogized them, and we talk about this a bit in the book, to the original neoconservatives back in the 1960s who were liberals who rebelled against liberalism. And over time, some of them went back to being more or less liberal Democrats like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, but some of them went over to the other side like Irving Kristol.
Right.
And I think it's going to be very interesting. And some, by the way, some of the anti-Trump conservatives are the children of these original neocons. I think it's going to be interesting to see, do these anti-Trump conservatives go back to being normal conservatives at the end of this, or has something happened that they become the forerunners of a kind of intellectual realignment? And the neocons couldn't deliver precincts, but they had a powerful effect in changing the public dialogue. And I'm very curious what's going to become of these anti-Trump conservatives.
Let me back up a
step.
Especially
in an era of polarization. I mean, so the flips of the Democrats to the GOP still came in the 70s, early 80s. You know, when there was still movement within the parties and there was still more of a center. And so today the question is, can you have that happen when the parties are so rigid?
And I think the answer is yes, because of Donald Trump.
Because
he broke up the alliance.
Well, because he broke up the alliance, and because the range of opinion opposed to Trump runs from the center to the left. There are a lot of very moderate Americans who really don't like Donald Trump. This isn't just when people – it's one of my critiques of the way anti-Trumpism is covered. It's covered as if the strong anti-Trump people are all lefties. That's not true at all. There are strong lefty anti-Trump people, but there are also very moderate people whose Trump's very lack of moderation bothers them deeply.
I don't know, love of moral principles, love of country, love of institutions, and not wanting to tear them down.
Yes.
These are patriotic principles that it's like somebody said on Twitter back during the Democratic campaign. Some conservative said, "Why are the Democrats talking?" It was sort of institutions and morals night. And somebody said, "Why are the Democrats don't talk about flag and country? That's our stuff." And then somebody said back to them on Twitter, "Well, you weren't using it, so we thought we'd take it." But I'm curious about this. Like, you talked about lefty anti-Trump people, and I'm curious about how to break down this polarization. And I wonder whether we can think of something here. It seems to me that speaking out against this disruptive thing that's happening in the last year, this tearing down of institutions. Often there'll be a response, "Oh, you're a liberal. Oh, I don't believe anything you say. You're a Democrat. You're a lefty. You're born in Kenya or whatever." So what would be the way, in terms of having a conversation, to actually break through that and say, "No, there are things we love about our country. There are things that are disruptive." Like, what's the way to break through that?
Well, you know, in our book, we have a whole chapter devoted to a new patriotism. The back half of our book tries to look forward and say, what does this broad movement that's gathered against Trump, and more specifically, what do progressives and Democrats need to think about if they want to both fight back against Trumpism and deal with some of the problems his rise underscores in the society? And so we talk about a new economy, because there's no question that the unequal distribution of the growth of the last 30 years was something that helped feed Trumpism. We talk about a new democracy where when Trump said the system is rigged, he was actually right, but not in the ways he said. And we talk about money and the court throwing out the Voting Rights Act and a lot of other measures that have hurt us that we think need to be reversed. But we also talk about a new civil society, where we talk about the breakdown of a lot of communities across the country, that the economic problems have led to social breakdown. And lastly, to get back to your point, we talk about a new patriotism, and we're very open about all the things we love about America. And paradoxically, many of the things we love about America, those of us who oppose Trump, are things that Trump is trying to reverse. Ethno-nationalism of his sort is far more a European import than something uniquely American. Yes, we've had had nativism in the past. I'm not saying that's not that there's a lot of that in our history. But the style of blood and soil politics is not in the American tradition. And that what do we regularly brag about as Americans? We brag about democracy. We brag about our free institutions. We brag about the fact that anybody can come here and succeed. We were proud of these things. And so we talk very strongly about a patriotism as an alternative to ethno-nationalism. And we think that people on the anti-Trump side really should be proud to wave the flag because the flag stands for a series of values that he is opposing.
Are you so? So you're. I always think of you as a real optimist, a hard-headed optimist about American politics.
Thanks for that addition. I appreciate that.
You wrote. I think it was in the mid '90s that your book on progressivism came out.
They only looked dead.
They only looked dead, and you had many skeptics, and many people then said, you know, you saw that revival actually take place. And this book is a book that has a similar message that in the middle of this chaos and some of the disillusioning part of politics, here's a path forward, and you lay out what has to happen from patriotism to the civil society, the economy. And I guess the question is, from your perspective, from your read of Washington, are the Democrats ready as a party to do this, to fulfill this kind of mission in the next few years, to move to this new agenda that would actually be a serious and substantive response, not just to President Trump, but to a Trumpist Republican politics?
You know, I wrote a book about religion some years ago, and the last line of the book is, hope is the virtue on which faith and love depend. And I don't want to take us off onto a theological discussion, but I think hope has always been an essential virtue to those who were, broadly speaking, progressive. Martin Luther King's line, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. And I think there's a lot of evidence for that, but sometimes it takes a very long time. Are the Democrats ready? Answer yes and no. Very Clintonian answer, I suppose some would say. Yes, in the sense that midterm elections are largely decided not on the basis of a prospective program, but as a retrospective referendum on the party in power. And I think that the opposition to Trump is strong enough that will, unless something radically changes between now and November, and Lord knows, after all my and other misfired predictions the last time, I'm always conscious of that danger. Nonetheless, if you look at the polls now, it seems pretty clear that the Democrats have enough of a lead to take the House, even in the face of the gerrymandered districts. And so I think they can get to that point. What am I worried about? I'm worried about the capacity of both progressives and Democrats to engage in an extraordinary amount of factionalism and sectarianism to tear each other apart. Either one side saying you're not pure enough, the other side saying the other side's too extreme. You can see those arguments coming. I am particularly worried about what I see as a dysfunctional debate between those who say Democrats must abandon identity politics, or the Democrats and progressives who say forget about the white working class. I think both of those are wrong, which means each of them is half right. To say let's abandon identity politics sounds to African Americans, Latinos, women, LGBTQ people, this sounds like, well, let's abandon them. And there's no way progressives and Democrats can or should abandon them. It's not good morally and it's not good politics. On the other hand, to say forget about the white working class assumes that Trump's share of the white non-college vote is permanent. It's not. The Obama coalition worked because in key states, notably Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio, Barack Obama managed to get a 40 to 50%, 40, 45% share of the white non-college vote. Hillary Clinton only managed a share of about 34, 35% in that range. That 10% was critical. And I think that group can be won back because Trump has really not kept his promises to that group, these steel tariffs notwithstanding, which are going to have a very uneven effect on their living standards anyway. So I think I worry about that fight, and I hope people manage to climb over it and say, all right, it's a fair point. We can't abandon the white working class. It's also a fair point that we can't abandon African-Americans, Latinos, and other groups that progressives have always stood
for.
Well,
it's sort of the reverse of what I understand to have happened to the Democratic Party in the 1930s, where the Democratic Party was united by the New Deal, but there was a significant part of the party, most of the party, that was not very into civil rights. Franklin Roosevelt himself included, didn't work at that at all. And the Democrats, led by unions, moved towards caring more and more about minorities because their civil rights, their economic rights were important. And so it was consistent with what—
And because African Americans moved north.
Right. So, but
this was also, I agree with that, but it was also very important that the interests of the Northern Party began to diverge, just practical electoral interests.
Right.
Ira Katz Nelson and others have written very well about this, that they began to diverge from those of the Southern Party. And if I can assume your point and take one step from
it. I just mean take back the white working class. That's where I was headed with that. So.
Right. But I think what's different now is the Franklin Roosevelt Democratic Party included outright racists in the South.
Right.
This coalition is far more coherent than the Roosevelt coalition.
That's right.
That the most moderate parts of it still broadly embrace the civil rights tradition. The people who oppose civil rights defected starting in, 1948, in some cases, 1964 in large numbers.
Yeah.
So you do have, even within the divisions of the Democratic Party, a far more ideologically coherent party than the New Deal Party was.
But to include the white working class, like, that's an identity. I mean, like, the thing
I agree.
The thing I was noticing in 2016 was that it was a time when whites became, at least white working class became an identity group, which, at some level, it's kind of a bummer when you go from being 80% of the population to going to 50% of the population. It kind of sucks to no longer being the dominant default group.
I think Nathan Glazer wrote a book some years ago, "We're All Multiculturalists Now," I think there is that sense of displacement that certainly played a role here. My friend Robbie Jones wrote a book called "The End of White Christian America," and it wasn't a book about whether this was good or bad. It was just a descriptive book about how the combination of the new diversity in the country and the growing number of young people who are religiously unaffiliated has ended the white Christian majority. So, and I think there's a reaction to that.
So yesterday in Robertson Auditorium here on campus, you addressed an audience and you asked everyone to say what the first word of the Constitution was. And everyone goes, "We." So I want you to connect that to what we've just been talking about.
Well, I love doing that because I said to the crowd, I asked them to say it because we don't say "we" enough as a country anymore. And the point I made in the speech is that we need to reclaim both the right and duty to say "we." And that I think that is one of the critiques of the Trump era that could also lead us away from some of the polarization. And Lord knows I am not a soupy optimist. I try to be a realistic, hopeful person. And this isn't going to happen easily. But I think this becomes more possible for a couple of reasons. Notice, for example, on issues of gay rights, the country has moved in a way that it has moved on no other issue in a very, very short time. There are a lot of quite conservative people, Americans, who say, "Look, I care about my gay brother-in-law, my gay cousin, my gay coworker." It's changed enormously. So we made great progress there toward "we." I think when you look at the Dreamers, virtually all Americans say, "Why in the world would we kick these folks out? This is not a minority position." If you look at guns, practical measures like background checks, like a ban on assault weapons, these are 75% issues. There are a lot of areas where we are a "we," and we have to find others where we're "we." And we also just have to say that we are living in a very challenging world right now with the rise of China, with Putin in charge of Russia, with Western Europe facing all these challenges. Look at the results of the Italian election this week. We need a sense of "we" again in the face of real dangers to the country.
We're almost out of time, but there's a different kind of question that I wanted to ask you. Last week we had Deborah Amos, and I was talking a little bit about her views on journalism, which she's been involved with so long. And I'm curious, you're an opinion writer. I don't know how you categorize yourself. That's what you now do. And that's a space that's hard in this media age. It's so fractious, and it's become so contentious. How do you think about what you do professionally to do it well? Because I think you do it very well, and you figured out how to do that with a perspective. How do you think of your work, and what would you say to any potential journalist listening?
Well, first of all, thank you for those very kind words. It took me a while, actually, to master opinion writing because I was an old-fashioned journalist right. for a very long time, and I took pride, and I still try to take pride in even when I knock an argument down to try to present the best rather than the worst version of it. I'm sure somebody could find columns where I'm guilty of straw man creation, but so it took me a while to get there. Two things. First, I really think it's essential to preserve that part of our business that is not opinion writing. I am most worried about opinion writing is flourishing right now. I am most worried about the declining finances, not even of the big national newspapers, but of a lot of local newspapers that cannot have the resources to cover city halls properly, state governments properly, not because they're bad-willed. It's because they don't have money the way they used to have. And I would think we desperately need that kind of reporting that gives people data to argue about. And by data, I don't just mean numbers, but here is what is going on. Now let's have an argument. And it's very easy to find here's what we're going to claim is going on to begin our argument without any relationship necessarily to the truth or the facts. So I think we got to support that side of journalism. It's why I'm glad to see, the Washington Post, my paper, the New York Times, and some others having some success and prosperity. But I worry all down to the local level where a lot of great local papers are really challenged. On the opinion side, one of the points we make in the book, and it was interesting because it was my colleague Tom Mann and I in our dialogue about the book. It was kind of crazy to write a book, three of us, but it was also very enriching for the conversations we had. And it was a result of that conversation that there's a line in the book that says, opinion journalism that is not based on fact is not journalism. Maybe opinion, but it's not journalism. And I think that those of us who are in the opinion world still need to hold ourselves to standards of fact. I think also we can help people. One of the reasons I like your work so much and your new book about Obama, give people a sense of history. And people might argue with our interpretation of history, but it ought to be an accurate reflection of what happened. So I think it's how can you have vigorous opinion writing
based on facts?
Yeah, as opposed to made up stuff.
That's a crisis that faces our democracy.
Well, it's good to have a voice, though, and someone on the show who's done such a great job with it. And your books have really been great, and they have kind of moved between the world of journalism and general readers, but also historians use it very often. Your book on Why Americans Hate Politics came out right when a lot of work on conservatism was emerging. It had a huge impact. So thanks again to E.J. Dionne for joining us. Again, he's a columnist for The Washington Post. You've seen him on television. You've heard him on radio. Also is at Brookings and teaches at Georgetown. And his new book that we've been discussing, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, with the great Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann. And the book is out with St. Martin's Press. So thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much.
And once again, you can find Politics and Polls on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
And we are not deported. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.